While you're walking around, up on your treadmill or strolling through the neighborhood, think of all the energy you're wasting. This past week, a team of researchers announced that they'd captured the excess energy generated by walking by strapping on a specialized 3.5-pound knee brace, then storing that energy in a battery. The battery can power all those electronic gadgets that seem to be taking over our lives.
You can walk for 1 minute to get 10 minutes of talk time for a current-day cell phone.
That's Art Kuo. He's an associate professor of mechanical engineering at the University of Michigan, and he's one of the inventors. I asked him what this contraption looks like.
It doesn't look too different from an athletic knee brace or something that you would wear after a knee injury. But what's different about it is that it has a small device added onto it that takes motion of the knee, and it transforms that into electrical power.
What is going on with walking that generates the energy?
Well, there's always motion going on, and it would be easy to use that to drive a generator. But I think what's different about our device is that we're looking for a point in walking where there's energy that's just being wasted. We found the best place so far to steal energy from the person is near the end of what we call the swing phase of walking, when one leg is off the ground and your knee is extending. There's a point where you're actually breaking the knee. You're slowing it down right before your foot hits the ground.
Okay, hold on. I see. I think I see that. I'm trying to do it here. It's okay, so you've picked your foot off the ground, picked up your foot, you've moved it forward to take a step, but
right.
It's sort of in that moment before it's fully extended to take a step.
Yes, and you may feel your hamstring pulling. That's the muscle that slows down your knee.
Wow. So does it work to put the brace on and, like, go shopping in the mall or stroll around, or do you have to be constantly moving, sort of with purpose walking?
It definitely works best when you're walking purposefully, but I would say that our current problem is that all we've done is produced a prototype, which is a proof of concept, and there's still a lot of development to be done to reduce the weight and the size, make it comfortable to wear, and then it's something that someone might not mind wearing while they're walking around.
What do you think this will be good for? I mean, these days we're all talking about having little solar panels to charge our cell phones and iPods. What do you envision this being used for?
In the Western world, it's true, even though it is a hassle to deal with the battery in your cell phone, you don't mind carrying it around and you are able to charge it. But a quarter of the world's population actually does not have ready access to electricity. And for them, battery power is part of their livelihood. And the military also, your typical soldier carries many pounds of batteries, and their livelihood depends on batteries for navigation and communication. And we could imagine people like them using a device like this to reduce their battery load.
You've called this a cocktail napkin idea. Did you actually have it at a party, and did you actually write it down on a cocktail napkin?
My recollection was that we were at a conference somewhere. This is Max Donnellan and I. He's the principal investigator. And we were discussing something peripherally related, and it came to us in a flash. And, in fact, we didn't even need the cocktail napkin. We were quite convinced that the principal made sense, but then there was still the problem of how to demonstrate that. This was an idea that came about very quickly and easily and then was followed by several years of hard work.
Art Kuo is a professor of mechanical engineering at the University of Michigan. Thanks very much, Professor.
Thank you. That was fun.
From the issue of education, we turn now to the environment. A body of water unites most of the people who are voting in Tuesday's Potomac primary, the Chesapeake Bay, the nation's largest estuary.
I mean, the bay is sort of at the bottom of the drain of a huge area of land. So everything that goes on in the land is affecting the bay.
Scientist Ken Staver is with the Y Research and Education Center, which sits on the bay's eastern shore. NPR's Dan Charles went there to talk to him for this report.
The Chesapeake Bay is not a wasteland. It's beautiful, actually. It is ailing, but many of its symptoms, the disappearing underwater grasses, declining crab and clam populations, aren't visible to a casual visitor. And the biggest cause of its ailment isn't obvious either. The bay is choking on plant food, nutrients like nitrogen and phosphorus dissolved in the water. And where do most of those nutrients come from? Ken Staver says farmers spread them mostly in the form of chemical fertilizers on their fields.
That's what you're looking at here, is one of the grain fields that would be producing something that goes into chicken poultry feed.
Or cattle feed or human food. But in this area, that grain with all its nitrogen and phosphorus goes mostly to big poultry operations. Giant warehouses filled with tens of thousands of chickens. Those operations are concentrated on the flat land on the eastern side of the bay. Most of those nutrients end up in manure, big stinking piles of chicken you-know-what that no one wants to haul very far.
The issue is when you concentrate animal production, you bring in feed for those animals, and then the economics have not been there for that waste, the nutrients in that waste, to be redistributed back to the cropland where the grain came from.
Instead, it's been spread on fields close to cattle barns or chicken houses where it wasn't really needed. From there, too much of it washed into the bay. Staver says the solution to this part of the bay's problem is send that manure, hundreds of thousands of tons of it, back to the fields where the nutrients originally came from. It's simple, at least in theory, but also inconvenient and expensive.
You know, we're going to have to do some things that are they're going to cost a little more than what we've done in the past. I mean, we've been looking for pain-free solutions, and I think we've run through most of those, and from here on, it's going to bite a little bit, and people are going to have to decide whether or not they want a clean bay in theory or whether they're willing to pay for it.
There has been some progress, Staver says. The state of Maryland is now helping to pay for shipping some of that chicken waste out of the region. And farmers now are required to show the government in writing how they will manage animal waste so it doesn't pile up and wash into the bay. Farmers say they're doing more than almost anyone to clean up the bay, but environmental groups aren't convinced. Because in Maryland, where the region's poultry operations are concentrated, those manure handling plans are kept confidential. Last week, one environmental organization, the Waterkeepers Alliance, sued the state, demanding access to those documents. The organization says it needs to know what farmers really are doing. Dan Charles, NPR News.
Voters in Maryland, Virginia, and Washington, D.C. will pick their party nominees on Tuesday, February 12th. A note that NPR News will have special coverage on the Potomac primaries on Tuesday, February 12th at 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time with NPR hosts Melissa Block and Michelle Norris. Today, however, all eyes will be on the Democratic caucuses in the state of Maine, where 24 delegates are at stake for Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Today, a federal appeals court rejected the Bush administration's plan for regulating mercury emissions from coal-fired power plants. Environmental groups in more than a dozen states that brought the suit say power plants will now have to clean up their emissions faster. NPR's Elizabeth Shogren reports.
Mercury can impair children's developing nervous systems, hurting their ability to think and learn. People are exposed to mercury by eating contaminated fish. In the United States, power plants are the biggest source of mercury pollution. The Bush administration's Environmental Protection Agency inherited a requirement to regulate power plant emissions. But instead of setting tough pollution limits for each plant, the administration wanted to create a cap-and-trade system. At the time, Jeff Homestead headed the EPA's air programs.
Some facilities can relatively cheaply get a 90% reduction. Other facilities have a very hard time even getting a 50% reduction. And so some plants can create emission credits that they can then sell to someone else who can't control as well.
The administration's plan would cut emissions by 70%, but big reductions actually wouldn't come for more than a decade. The EPA had to first take mercury from power plants off the list of hazardous air pollutants because those pollutants must be controlled quickly and from every plant. The federal appeals court in D.C. rejected the Bush administration's approach. In fact, it accused it of using, quote, the logic of the Queen of Hearts.
The Queen of Hearts was one of the Alice in Wonderland characters who was supremely illogical.
James Pugh is a lawyer for Earth Justice. He argued the case for environmental groups and 16 states.
The whole point of Alice's trip through Wonderland is that she keeps running into characters who make no sense at all. whenever the court starts making allusions to Alice in Wonderland, you know that what the agency has done doesn't make very much sense.
Pugh says now the EPA will have no choice but to come up with a new rule that will be very strict and apply to every power plant. But EPA's Jonathan Schrader says the court did not rule out a cap-and-trade system.
Cap-and-trade could potentially be back in another form.
Schrader says the EPA has not decided whether it will appeal the ruling, but he says there will be years of delay.
We're very disappointed that the court rolled back essentially the first ever regulation for mercury emissions from power plants, first ever on the globe.
About half the states have approved mercury regulations that are tougher than the federal rules, and at least some of them expect to be able to push ahead with their programs. Pennsylvania's plan requires cuts of 80% by 2010 and 90% by 2015.
We're full steam ahead.
Kathleen McGinty is Pennsylvania's Secretary of Environmental Protection.
Mercury isn't just any kind of pollutant. It is a dangerous neurotoxin that snaps away the future of young children.
McGinty says it was wrong for the Bush administration to delay big cuts in mercury pollution for more than a decade because of what's at risk.
And on top of that, we have the technology to get the job done, and it's cost-effective technology.
It's not clear what many other states will do, especially those that had adopted the Bush plan. Homestead, the former EPA official, now represents power companies as a lawyer and lobbyist.
There's an enormous amount of uncertainty here about what happens next.
He predicts there will be lots of litigation until the EPA comes up with a new mercury rule, probably under the next administration. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News, Washington.
Well, as loyal BPP listeners know, January was National Hobby Month, and we took the opportunity to feature gorilla knitters, campaign button collectors, yo-yo fanatics.
Love that.
Well, we like the series so much, we're keeping it around and declaring it National Hobby Year.
Some boys like to hunt and fish, and some like to sail the sea. I'd take up photography to build a dark room for you and me as my hobby. I want you for my
Yes, in our continuing series of extreme hobbies, there's a group of people out there who like to watch. There are people who can spot and monitor satellites, you know, the ones that support GPS and Google Earth, and then the ones we aren't supposed to know about, the secret spy satellites up in the sky. While it's fairly easy these days to feel like you are being watched, these satellite spotters, they're watching back. Joining us now from his home in Toronto is Ted Moultson, energy conservation consultant by day and one of the world's best-known satellite spotters by night. How you doing, Ted?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing just great. So how easy is it for you to identify a satellite in the sky?
Well, a lot easier than people might suspect.
Hmm. Well, what are the telltale signs?
Well, as far as a spy satellite, they generally don't look any different than any of the other satellites. So it takes some detective work to separate them out. You know, there are thousands of things orbiting the Earth, and spy satellites are a fairly small percentage of them.
And so when you say it takes a little bit of detective work, can you describe that for me?
Well, sure. One of the ways it happens is we know in advance that a spy satellite is going to be launched. You know, that aspect of it cannot be kept secret, and the U.S. government does not attempt to make that secret. So we know well in advance that a satellite is going up, and we know from where it is going up. There are only two locations. It could go from Cape Canaveral or Vandenberg Air Force Base. And we also can learn quite easily what direction the rocket is going to go into, partly because it is necessary to inform mariners and aviators where over the ocean they should avoid, because pieces of the rocket, like rocket stages, shroud covers, are going to fall. And that gives us a clue as to the direction of the satellite. So that gives you maybe a bit of a flavor of how we go about this. We use open source information to help narrow down what kind of orbit the satellite would have gone into.
And when you're saying, you're talking about these communications, are you listening through on various radio frequencies? Is this all information that you and other satellite spotters trade? How do you find this out?
Well, there is some radio involved, but perhaps not in the way you might think.
Mm-hmm.
We don't listen in on, you know, communications going on within the government controlling the satellites or any of that. But some of my colleagues do monitor radio beacons and other signals on the satellites. So that is one aspect of it. Most of the observing is done visually. We basically see the satellites through binoculars or telescopes.
So you don't really have any super special high-powered equipment, just a good old-fashioned set of binoculars and a telescope?
Well, that would pretty much do it. with binoculars, the bigger the better. But the ones that most people take to a ball game, a 7x50 binoculars, would be a good entry point into the hobby. If you get serious with it and want to see fainter things, then there are bigger binoculars, and they're not very expensive.
Now, is there a certain part of the country or a certain time of year that makes it best for satellite spotting?
Well, not really. They can be seen any place in the world. Now, if you live in the mid-northern latitudes where I do, you know, around 45 degrees north, right around that latitude, we do get a lot of cloud cover in the winter. So in that sense, the winter is not as good for observing the sky as the summer. But that's a local thing that affects, you know, mainly the northern hemisphere.
We're talking to Ted Motsan. He's a conservation consultant by day, and he's one of the world's best-known satellite spotters by night. So, Ted, how did you get into this? Did you just wake up one day and think, I'm going to go outside and look for some satellites?
No, it wasn't quite like that. I grew up in the 60s when space exploration was just getting underway. And like a lot of kids, I was inspired by, you know, seeing rockets being launched on television, seeing astronauts go up. All of this was new then. And at some point, probably when I was around 10 or 11 years of age, I saw my first satellite go over. And that made the whole thing all that more seemingly tangible to me, actually seeing with my own eyes something made by humans that had been, blasted into space. And so I was fascinated by that. And, you know, from there, slowly over the years, as I got older and learned more, I found myself wanting to understand more about orbits and be able to predict when satellites come over and the like. I didn't get into spy satellites until the late 80s.
Now, what was it about the late 80s that made you dive into spy satellites?
Well, after a 10-year hiatus from the hobby while I finished my education and, you know, started my working life, I got a little more settled, had a little more spare time I could spend on hobbies and stuff, and started to find myself wanting to get back into the hobby. Also, at that time, I wanted to get involved in making scientific observations relating to satellites, because there had been a long tradition of use of amateur observations of satellites for scientific research. So I learned how to make those kinds of observations, contacted the people who are involved in that, and through them, I met people who were a sort of a subset of that group who were also interested in spy satellite observing.
But here's the thing I wonder about spy satellites. I have two questions about. One is, if they're spy satellites, I'm assuming no one wants the people who put them up there, they don't want other people to know they're up there. So is it difficult to find them? I mean, are you having a difficult time deciphering where they are?
Well, not really.
Now, doesn't that scare you a little bit, that not really, that you can figure out where spy satellites are that perhaps our own government has put up there?
It doesn't scare me. I suppose it could give someone pause for thought. But to give some perspective to it, most people don't know that up until 1983, the U.S. government did not classify the orbits of any of its spy satellites. They were all made public along with all the thousands of other pieces up there. And so somehow, you know, managed to get through the worst of the Cold War, keeping this stuff quite out in the open. So it's still somewhat mysterious as to why suddenly they were classified when they were.
Have you ever held back information from being published on your website or shared on various community boards because you were afraid that it would fall into the wrong hands? I mean, there could be people who would use this information for doing things that are not so great.
Well, I can imagine that there were people who might try to do that. I question whether, you know, it would get them very far. But to answer your question, no, we've never withheld our information because of concerns that it would fall into the wrong hands.
And is there a holy grail for satellite spotters, one satellite that's been rumored to exist that everybody's out there searching for but hasn't spotted yet?
No, actually, we don't spend a lot of time searching, believe it or not. When something new is launched, then we will devote some time to searching. We will usually develop a plan well in advance, And sometimes we will find those satellites literally, in the shortest, was within seconds of its reaching orbit. Sometimes it'll take days, weeks, months. But usually we don't have the time. This is a hobby. We all have day jobs. Many of us have, spouses and families and other responsibilities. So the hobby has to fit within, some kind of a reasonable lifestyle.
Now, before I let you go, I'm curious about, we all read the newspapers about this satellite that's going to fall to Earth. That everybody kept talking about this piece of the satellite that was going to hit somewhere. When you heard information like that, someone who spends their life, part of their life anyway, dealing in the world of satellites, what did you think? Did you think, oh, that's a non-story, that happens all the time, or wow, I wonder where that thing's going to hit?
It was more the former.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, I knew exactly what satellite they were talking about.
Of course you did.
I was out for the day visiting with friends and came home late that evening when that story broke. And was surprised to see, my voicemail messages line flashing and emails from the press. And they didn't say what satellite, but I immediately knew which one. I predicted a year earlier that it was coming back to Earth in March. It's a small research and development satellite, we believe. I doubt that it weighs much more than, 5,000-6,000 pounds. I doubt that there's anything particularly hazardous on it that would survive all the way to the ground. Perhaps some rocket fuel. Most of that should burn up on the way down.
Well, let's hope you're right about that. Ted Mosan, we appreciate you sharing your hobby with us.
I'm glad to do it.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Biofuels, like corn ethanol, have been hailed as a climate-friendly source of energy. But a new study says that burning those alternative fuels is actually twice as bad as burning gasoline from the standpoint of global warming. As NPR's Richard Harris reports, if the findings hold, they could force major changes in the rapidly growing biofuels industry.
At first blush, biofuels like corn ethanol and soybean diesel seem like they'd be great from the standpoint of global warming. The crops soak up carbon dioxide from the atmosphere as they grow, and that balances out the carbon dioxide they produce when they're burned. But until now, nobody has fully analyzed all the ripple effects of this industry. And Tim Searchinger, a visiting scholar at Princeton University, says those effects turn out to be huge.
The simplest explanation is that when we divert our corn or soybeans to fuel, if people around the world are going to continue to eat the same amount that they're already eating, you have to replace that food somewhere else.
Searchinger and his colleagues looked globally to figure out where the new cropland is coming from as American farmers produce fuel crops where they used to grow food. The answer is that biofuel production here is driving agriculture to expand in other parts of the world.
That's done in significant part by burning down forest, plowing up grassland. That releases a great deal of carbon dioxide.
In fact, their study, published online today by Science Magazine, shows those actions end up releasing huge amounts of carbon dioxide. The study finds that over a 30-year span, biofuels end up contributing twice as much carbon dioxide to the air as the amount of gasoline would when you add in these global effects.
Right now, there's little doubt that ethanol is making global warming worse.
Searchinger's team says these fuels are turning out to be anything but environmentally friendly. Alex Farrell at the University of California, Berkeley, agrees.
I think this paper will have major implications for the use of biofuels around the world.
Here in the United States, the federal government is offering large subsidies to encourage corn-based ethanol. That's a boon to Midwestern farmers and provides a domestic supply of fuel. The Bush administration is calling for a vast expansion of this industry as part of a plan to reduce gasoline consumption by 20%.
If you care about greenhouse gases, then this expansion of the corn biofuel industry is going in the wrong direction.
Farrell says the new study will clearly need to be verified with similar analyses, but he says the overall conclusion looks solid. And it's not just an academic matter. Federal law says future biofuel sources will eventually need to be certified as benefiting the climate. If the new study holds up to scrutiny, America's main industry, corn-based ethanol, would flunk that test.
Well, what is their solution?
Matt Hartwig is a spokesman for the Renewable Fuels Association, a trade group. He says the world needs more energy, and ethanol is filling a need.
I mean, sure, today ethanol production or renewable fuel technology itself is not perfect, but it is evolving and becoming better.
But the new study concludes that even vast efficiency improvements in ethanol production won't change the equation. As long as the starting material is grown on farmland, Searchinger says biofuels will be bad for the planet.
But Alex Farrell at Berkeley does see a way out of this. He says the focus of the biofuels industry needs a rapid change of direction, away from using cropland, which is where most U.S. biofuels come from today, and toward other sources of starting material.
We could replace all of the ethanol that we consume in California just using waste that goes to the landfill today and turning that into ethanol.
Environmentally friendly biofuels could also be made from agricultural waste or grasses grown on land that's not suitable for crops. The biofuels industry is heading in that direction, but the technology to make use of fuels other than corn and soy is still in its infancy. Richard Harris, NPR News.
They tried to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no.
One of the songs nominated for Best Record of the Year is this tune, Rehab, by Amy Winehouse. But the 24-year-old soul singer won't be at the Grammys this weekend because she's in rehab, for real. 2 weeks ago, Winehouse checked herself into a London facility shortly after video of her smoking what looked like a crack pipe surfaced on celebrity news shows like TMZ.
Amy ending up in a home video apparently smoking crack is not exactly shocking news. Back in December, Photogs caught her with what looked like white powder in her nose.
In recent months, tales of stars with drug and alcohol problems have become all too familiar.
Shock news this morning. I was shocked to hear this, that Kirsten Dunst, Hollywood starlet, the latest to head for rehab.
This woman, Nicole Richie, arrested earlier today for DUI.
We've learned that Eva Mendes has been in rehab at the Cirque Lodge in Utah, the same place where Lindsay Lohan was, for a couple weeks now.
And just this week, the New York Medical Examiner announced that actor Heath Ledger's death was caused by an accidental overdose, the result of taking six different painkillers and sedatives.
Celebrities love to party, but many of them don't know when to stop.
Stars struggling with drug and alcohol addiction has become so common lately, it's even the premise for a new reality show on VH1.
I'm Dr. Drew, and this is Celebrity Rehab.
Especially now, when the paparazzi trail a star's every move, it's easy to see why celebs struggle with dependencies, says Gary Stromberg, who wrote a book on the subject titled The Harder They Fall.
To be a star takes a great deal of courage. You know, and not all of us are possessed with that kind of courage.
Stromberg says many celebrities turn to drugs and alcohol as a way to fill emotional voids, voids that run deep in a world where you can be all the rage one week and completely forgotten the next. Though that's nothing new, he says the way stars deal with addiction has changed a lot.
It's only in the last, 20 years that rehab has existed at all. Bela Lugosi, goes back now to the 30s and the 40s. He went to the Norwalk Hospital for the Criminally Insane. That's how alcoholism was treated in those days.
These days, celebrities are much more likely to wind up someplace like this. There's a koi pond in front of the sprawling $22 million Malibu estate that's home to an addiction treatment center called Passages. Chris Prentice is the center's founder.
We've treated lots of celebrities, and their treatment is exactly the same as everyone else's treatment.
That includes intense group and individual therapy, hypnotherapy, massage, acupuncture, and yoga. But rehab here isn't cheap.
The cost for a one-month stay is $67,550.
Prentice says he's happy to help any celebrity overcome addiction, but he does have some reservations about the message that sends, especially to young people.
When celebrities go out and use, because so many of them are going to rehab now, teenagers think that it's okay to go out and use.
We live in this culture where alcohol and other drug use is glamorized.
Susan Foster is with Columbia University's National Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse.
A related issue is what good the rehab is. I mean, sometimes you almost are led to believe that celebrities go into rehab as a way to avoid other kinds of sanctions.
Foster says when celebs go to rehab just to get out of bad PR, treatment probably won't work. They're likely to wind up back in rehab, and that sends the wrong message to the public, too.
If you have this continual focus on the fact that people aren't getting well, that sort of adds to the sense of despair or the worry that maybe I can't succeed.
Foster does see one positive aspect to the recent media attention on celebrities and addiction. She says it provides parents an excellent opportunity to talk to their kids about alcohol and drug use.
And according to her research, open dialogue at home is still the best preventative measure. NPR's Day to Day continues.